allowed into her room at that time of night, without her being very much on her guard. If she had no other lover among the guests, then aside from myself, the only other man of the company I could imagine her inviting in, without a qualm, would be her brother-in-law. As far as she knew, she had nothing to fear from Connell. To my mind, he should be at the top of your list of suspects for her murder, but we'll never have any proof short of a confession. He focused on Crawford. Unless you learned anything from the staff? Crawford shook his head. Not a thing. None of them were in that part of the house at that time. Sebastian nodded. That was to be expected. However, there's something that's been nagging at me about Connell's alibi for Ennis's murder. You told Lady Antonia and me that it was difficult to see how Connell could have stabbed Ennis late enough to meet the doctor's timetable, then got to the end of the library in time to be seen sitting there by Parrish and Fanshawe, without also being seen going into the library by them. Sebastian paused as Worthington, Filbury and Wilson, now mounted and looking intent and grim, walked their horses up and reined in to wait for the others. Fanshawe had already walked his horse out. He brought his gelding to join the other three and swung up to the saddle. Sebastian looked at Hadley. Fanshawe, on the evening that Ennis was murdered, when you and Parrish came upon Boyne reading in the library, how long was it between the time you set eyes on Boyne in the chair at the end of the library and the clock striking 10? Hadley met Sebastian's gaze, then he frowned, and his expression grew distant.
More than 1 minute, 2? Probably.
He refocused on Sebastian.
We came into the library and saw Boyne at the end. Parrish and I exchanged glances, then we ambled down the room, it's a long room, and then started chatting with Boyne. So, all in all, I would say between 2 and 3 minutes passed before the clock struck. I doubt it was longer.
Sebastian looked at the inspector.
When you considered Connell's alibi, did you take into account the second door into the library, the one in the corridor wall directly opposite the billiards room door?
Crawford's expression drained.
What?
Sebastian went on.
It's not a concealed door, but it fits so well into the panelling, it would be easy to miss seeing it. Connell would have known about that door. It's at the end of the library, where he was found sitting, and it's only a few paces from the study door. He didn't need to go around into the front hall to enter the library through the main door. If Connell left the study at the same time as Fanshawe and Parrish left the dining room, they wouldn't have seen him, and he would have been in that chair when they entered the library.
Good God! Crawford's expression was a medley of surprise, chagrin, and delight. Damn! That's how he did it.
Indeed.
Sebastian gathered his reins and mounted. He settled in the saddle.
But there's something else that seemed contrived.
He looked at Worthington, Filbury, and Wilson.
Did Connell read much?
Good God, no,
came from all three throats. Then all three looked struck. After a moment, Worthington slowly said,
I've never seen him with a book in his hand in all the time I've known him, and I've known him for a good 10 years, ever since coming on the town. Well, that's that thread tied off.
Crawford glanced around, noted McGibbon and Parrish trotting up, gathered his reins, and mounted. Connell Boyne is our murderer.
If you want a rationale for how and why he killed Cecilia, Antonia coolly said, we've told you she was worried, even fearful, on that last night. She'd started to suspect something of what was behind Ennis's murder. I think she turned to Connell. He was Ennis's brother, and she trusted him. Why wouldn't she? Her husband had. I think she might well have asked Connell to come to her room. When he did, she poured out her suspicions.
Antonia looked at Filbury and Wilson.
Possibly, courtesy of that conversation you two had with her in the conservatory, she misinterpreted your concerns and suspected one or both of you. But Connell couldn't have Cecilia raising such concerns with the inspector or Sir Humphrey.
So he killed her. Sir Humphrey's tone suggested that there was no longer any question about that. The magistrate heaved himself into the saddle, all in cold blood. Crawford shook his head. This is a bad business all around. Sir Humphrey settled in his saddle and looked over the assembled company. Right then, we're all here? He swung his horse's head toward the stable arch. So let's get after the blighter. They clattered out of the stable yard and set course for Canterbury. When they reached the fields, Sir Humphrey directed them to spread out, and they galloped steadily on in pursuit of Conall Boyne. Antonia galloped on, holding the mare in position in the grim line between Sebastian and Hadley. The ground was damp, soft enough to hold tracks, and the inspector, Filbury, and Sebastian were all exceedingly good at picking them out. That said, the afternoon light was waning, fading by degrees, and an autumnal mist was springing up, hanging low over the fields. Consequently, Sir Humphrey had ordered them to spread out, in case Boyne swerved abruptly. The pace they were maintaining was moving them through the fields quickly, yet with little chance of missing any sudden diversion Boyne might have made. They were still well within the estate when a riderless horse came galloping toward them. Wilson, who had an excellent seat and hands and rode with instinctive confidence, diverted to intercept the beast, and Worthington and Parrish broke from the line and followed. "Everyone else keep riding," Sir Humphrey bellowed. They did, all now peering ahead into the gathering gloom. 3 minutes later, Wilson, Worthington and Parrish rejoined the line, with Wilson leading the other horse. "Is it Boyne's?" the inspector called. "We think so," Parrish replied. "It's from the Hall stables, and other than us, who else had a horse out?" They all digested that. Riding on Sebastian's other side, Sir Humphrey turned to him. "Any chance you more than winged him?" Sebastian shook his head. "If I'd wounded him more severely, it would have slowed him down before he barreled out of the depths of the house. And the cavern where I shot him was just back from the shore. He'd covered a fair distance on foot in a reasonable time when he emerged, yet he made it to the stable, got on a horse, and rode off." He paused, then grimaced. "It's possible the effort and the blood loss have caught up with him, and he's fallen off." Sir Humphrey grunted. He settled back in his saddle and called to the company to keep their eyes peeled for a body on the ground. Antonia hesitated, then leaned forward and called across Sebastian to Sir Humphrey. "Connell might have met someone with a carriage and turned the horse loose." Sebastian grimaced. Sir Humphrey looked disgusted. "That puts a different complexion on things." He raised his voice again. "Damn it! Let's pick up the pace! We don't want to lose the beggar!" Sebastian and the inspector pulled a little ahead. Filbury joined them, all three keeping their gazes trained down, following the tracks imprinted on the grassy ground. The group forged on. Connell hadn't leapt fences, but had left gates swinging wide. Although he detoured to go through the gates, he invariably returned to his northwesterly course. It became increasingly clear that he was making for the northwest corner of the estate. Antonia remembered the dense coppice that occupied that area. If one wanted to rendezvous with someone coming from elsewhere, and be sure no one on the estate would see, that coppice was perfect in structure, location, and isolation. Sure enough, Connell's horse's tracks led directly to the entrance to the narrow path, meandering to the clearing in the centre of the large coppice. They all drew rein,
dismounted, and tied their mounts to trees along the edge of the coppice. Sebastian, Filbury, and Crawford were crouched just inside the edge of the trees, examining the surface of the path. They rose, as together with all the others, Antonia joined them. The inspector met Sir Humphrey's gaze and tipped his head along the path.
He's gone striding in. No sign he's staggering.
He'd kept his voice just above a whisper, but then looked down the path and humphed.
Chances are he's well on his way, but we'd better check.
The path was only wide enough for one. Crawford led the way, with Sir Humphrey at his heels, with Sebastian, Antonia's hand again in his, behind the magistrate. The others followed Antonia in single file. When they'd visited the coppice earlier in the day, by standing in his stirrups on the tall grey, Sebastian had been able to see through the largely bare branches into the clearing, but only well enough to discern that there was no building hidden within it. At ground level, the density of trunks and saplings restricted their view. It wasn't until, behind Sir Humphrey, Sebastian stepped into the clearing itself, obviously created to allow more effective access to the trees in the centre of the unusually large coppice, that he could fully observe the enclosed space. It was larger than he'd expected, large enough that four trees had been allowed to grow in a clump in the clearing centre. Conall Boyne was sitting on the ground, facing away from them, with his back against one of the central trees. Crawford had checked at the sight of him. Now he went forward cautiously. "Conall Boyne!" Boyne didn't react. Sebastian's imagination immediately provided a reason for Boyne's stillness, but he held the thought at bay and followed Sir Humphrey as, still moving slowly, the group split into two. Half followed Crawford clockwise around the trees, while the rest, including Sebastian and Antonia, followed Sir Humphrey in an anti-clockwise direction. Crawford was the first to look down on their quarry, the inspector's features set. Boyne sat slumped with his legs stretched out before him. Sir Humphrey joined the inspector several paces back from Boyne's boots. The magistrate grimaced. Sebastian and Antonia came up beside Sir Humphrey. It was transparently clear that Conall Boyne was dead. Quite aside from the bloody furrow above his left elbow that Mrs. Parrish had described, there was now a gaping, still sluggishly seeping hole in the left side of his chest. Sebastian eased out a slow breath. Antonia tightened her grip on his hand, and he squeezed her fingers. All the other men joined them. Everyone stood silently looking down on what remained of Conall Boyne. Then Antonia murmured,
"He came here to meet someone. A meeting arranged beforehand. Conall expected to leave, to get away, with whoever he met. That's why he let his horse go."
The other men glanced at her curiously. They didn't know anything about the motives behind the murders, about Connell's involvement in a serious plot.
"Yes."
His expression like stone, Crawford nodded. "But whoever he met killed him instead." A breeze stirred the last of the autumn leaves still clinging to the branches, setting up a dry, rustling susurration. The mist was thickening, lending a ghostly aura to the scene. Sebastian stirred.
"Dead men can't talk."
He glanced at Antonia, then at Sir Humphrey and Crawford.
"Lady Antonia and I have to return to London."
Chapter 15. In what felt like an omen, the city's bells were tolling 10 o'clock when Sebastian drew his greys to a stamping halt outside St. Ives' house. Wilkins leapt down to the pavement, rushed up the steps,
and plied the knocker, then returned to assist Becky to the ground before running to hold the horses' heads. Sebastian stepped down, surrendered the reins to the young groom in St. Ives livery, who came pelting up the area's steps, then went to the phaeton's side and handed Antonia down.
Becky.
Safely on the pavement, Antonia turned to her maid.
We'll be spending the night at St. Ives' house. The Marquis and I have business to attend to, which is likely to keep us out very late. You don't need to wait up.
Becky bobbed a curtsy.
Yes, miss.
As she straightened, she asked,
Should I unpack your things?
Just what I need for the night.
Antonia glanced at Sebastian. He briefly met her gaze, then looked over Becky's head at Wilkins, who nodded. Despite the rush of leaving Pressingstoke Hall, Sebastian had found time to instruct Wilkins to tell the St. Ives housekeeper to put Antonia in the room next to his. He reached for her arm, linked it with his, and turned her along the street.
Let's see if fortune has elected to favour us, and Drake's at home.
He, and he felt sure Antonia too, fervently hoped Drake had returned from Ireland. To him, her Sir Humphrey and Inspector Crawford, the manner of Conall Boyne's slaying had underscored the seriousness of the plot in which Boyne had, clearly, played his part. That, and 10 hundredweight of gunpowder, tended to focus the mind wonderfully. After finding Boyne dead, with Sir Humphrey's and Crawford's blessings, Sebastian and Antonia had immediately left the coppice and ridden hell for leather back to the house. They'd flung themselves into a flurry of packing, dallied only long enough for Antonia to farewell her friends and assure them that Hadley would explain all when he returned. Then she and Sebastian had climbed into the phaeton, and he'd driven them back to town in record time. Wolverstone House was 100 yards further along the north side of Grosvenor Square. Sebastian escorted Antonia up the steps, then wielded the knocker. Light could be seen through the transom window. When the butler Hamilton opened the door, they saw the front hall was fully lit. Hamilton recognized them instantly. Before they could say anything, he bowed.
Lord Irith, my lady.
He smoothly stepped back and waved them inside. Surmising that Drake had mentioned they might arrive, with his hand at Antonia's back, Sebastian ushered her inside. Immediately Hamilton closed the door, Sebastian asked,
I take it the Marquis is at home.
Indeed, sir.
Hamilton reached for Antonia's cloak.
He arrived not 15 minutes ago and is presently bathing. He said you might call, and that if you did, the matter would be urgent.
He relieved Antonia of her bonnet as well, then accepted the greatcoat Sebastian shrugged off.
I will inform his lordship of your arrival immediately.
Thank you.
Please confirm that the matter is indeed urgent. Oh, and Hamilton.
Yes, my lord.
Is there any chance of something to eat? We've driven direct from the Kent coast and haven't eaten since an early lunch.
Hamilton looked pleased. The man was known to thrive on domestic challenges.
Of course, my lord. If you and Lady Antonia will make yourselves comfortable in the drawing room, I will arrange for a suitable repast to be served momentarily.
Antonia added her thanks to Sebastian's, and they walked into the long, formal drawing room. A cheery fire was crackling in the grate. Antonia led the way to one of the matching pair of sofas, facing each other across the Orbison rug, spread before the fireplace, and sank onto the silk damask with a sigh. Sebastian followed and sat beside her. After a moment, he reached across, closed his hand about one of hers, then raised her fingers to his lips and pressed a kiss to her knuckles. Then he lowered their linked hands to rest on his thigh, sat back, closed his eyes, and let the peace and stability, the tranquility of the house and of her, wrap about him. 10 minutes later,
all of which they'd spent in blissful silence, Hamilton came to summon them to the smaller dining room, the one the family used. The table could seat 12, and given the size of the current ducal couple's family, that was sometimes only just enough. Three places had been set at one end, with a plethora of dishes already arrayed before them. Hamilton sat Antonia in the seat to the right of the carver, leaving Sebastian to claim the place beside her.
"The Marquis requests that you make a start without him. He too hasn't yet dined, and will join you as soon as he's able."
Hamilton lifted the lid of a tureen.
"I can recommend the oyster soup."
A savoury aroma emerged, carried on the steam. Antonia nodded eagerly. Sebastian's mouth watered. After serving them, being experienced in the ways of his masters, Hamilton filled their wine glasses, then retreated. They were supping second servings of the delicious soup when the door opened and Drake entered. Antonia lowered her soup spoon and blinked.
"Good Lord."
Resplendent in a dark, multi-hued silk velvet dressing gown, thrown over a shirt and soft trousers, Drake shut the door carefully, then strolled slowly forward. He waved languidly.
"Pray excuse my déshabille, Antonia."
She pointed at the carver.
"For God's sake, sit before you fall down."
With a small, quite gentle smile, Drake moved to obey. Antonia found herself staring at the dark circles around Drake's hooded eyes. His habitual languid drawl had sounded more drawly than usual, and the way he moved. She'd never seen the normally vigorous and virile Drake so drained and depleted. He looked as if he might collapse in a heap at any moment. He made it into the chair, sinking into the embrace of the carver as if he was a much older man. But his golden eyes had already surveyed the dishes and their plates.
"Is that oyster soup?"
"Yes."
Antonia reached out and picked up the soup ladle. When Drake handed her his soup plate, she took it, added two ladlefuls of the creamy liquid, then handed it back.
"Eat. You look like a shadow of your former self."
His long lips twitched. He exchanged a look with Sebastian.
"I understand you've rushed up non-stop from Kent."
He paused to take a mouthful of the soup.
"Against that, I've been travelling for the past 2 days, some of it running. Literally."
Leaving him to eat and hopefully recover his strength along with his usual incisive wits, Antonia set aside her emptied soup plate and served herself a helping of what appeared to be braised venison. She passed the dish to Sebastian, who handed her a dish of assorted boiled vegetables in return. While they ate, she was aware of Drake's eagle's gaze, assessing them, something that bothered neither her nor Sebastian. They'd long grown used to Drake's rather acute scrutiny. There was no real way to avoid it, and it was only an issue if one had something one wanted to hide. Speaking of which, Antonia noticed the knuckles on Drake's right hand were scraped. She contemplated the sight, then glanced to her right at Sebastian's hands. Looking again at Drake, she caught his eye and nodded at his hand.
"You should have worn gloves."
Drake glanced at his knuckles and faintly winced.
"Gloves wouldn't have fitted with the costume. I shouldn't have been there at all, but..."
He shrugged.
"I mean,"
she persisted,
"that if you want to pass for someone of lower station, you need to wear gloves. Your hands..."
With her gaze, she directed his attention to Sebastian's.
"Are like his.
Long-fingered and elegant.
They immediately mark you for what you are."
Drake looked mildly taken aback.
"Perhaps that was it."
from which Antonia deduced he'd been playing one of his charades, had been found out, and had had to fight his way free. Drake finished his soup and pushed aside his plate. After a moment, as if infused with renewed, renewing energy, he sat straighter. As he helped himself to the venison, he murmured, "You both look rather rumpled. Definitely not your usual debonair selves. I take it your day was eventful." Sebastian had cleared his plate and was feeling human once more. He set down his cutlery, pushed aside the plate, reached for his wine glass, and leaned back in the chair.
"Let's see. Dealing with a Scotland Yard inspector and a magistrate, both engaged in investigating two murders, then riding out searching farmhouses, cottages, hay sheds, barns, and the like for barrels of gunpowder, then scrambling down a cliff face, trudging through sand, following a tunnel into a dark cavern, finding evidence of 10 barrels of gunpowder having been stored there, being shot at and having to take a dive, then racing back out to the beach, scrambling back up the cliff, riding like the wind across the estate, then riding out again in pursuit of the murderer, also the only one we knew of who could tell us about that gunpowder, only to find the man dead, shot." Sebastian arched his brows. "Then we had to pack and drive up to town, so yes, eventful enough." Drake had frozen in the act of skewering a potato. "Gunpowder." He stared at Sebastian, then looked at the potato, stabbed it, transferred it to his plate, then imperiously waved at them both. "Start at the beginning, and if at all possible, leave nothing crucial out." Sebastian settled to relate all that had happened from the moment they'd arrived at Pressingstoke Hall. Antonia added her observations as appropriate. When informed of Ennis's last words, Drake frowned. "Gunpowder here." After a moment, he shook his head. "At least you managed to find it." "Unfortunately not. We only found where it had been." Sebastian continued describing all the pertinent events up to the point of them discovering the imprint of 10 barrels in the cavern off the beach, and their deduction that the barrels had been moved during the previous night.
"So most likely into a wagon, and most likely ferried up to London."
Drake paused, then refocused on Sebastian.
"And then?"
With several interjections from Antonia, Sebastian recounted how they'd been shot at by the man involved, who had proved to be Connell Boyne, how they'd missed catching him at the house and had given chase, and subsequently found him murdered in the coppice. Drake had finished eating, and like Sebastian, was now sitting back in the carver and sipping wine. He grunted,
"Dead men pass on no information."
He sipped, then frowned.
"But why was it necessary to kill him? Why not just spirit him away?"
Sebastian shrugged.
"Too risky, now the authorities knew who they were looking for?"
Drake's golden eyes narrowed.
"Possibly."
After several moments, he said,
"The way I see this, Ennis, as well as his brother Connell, had been secretly supporting the Young Islander movement. But in Ennis's case, that support was by donation and encouragement, rather than being actively involved. Connell, on the other hand, appears to have been seduced into actively working for the cause, given he spent most of his time on the Ennis estate in Ireland. It's not hard to see how that might have come about."
"Possibly without Ennis knowing,"
Antonia said.
She too was sitting back, cradling her glass, and listening avidly. Drake inclined his head in agreement. He focused on the goblet he was slowly twirling between his long fingers. After a moment, his eyes hooded, he continued,
"I was summoned to Ireland because my sources had heard whispers of some major plot being afoot. By the time I arrived in Dublin, they'd heard that the plot involved gunpowder. Subsequently, I learned that a group of young islanders had secured a quantity of gunpowder. Exactly how much, I didn't find out, and it had been dispatched to somewhere in England's south. The ship had already sailed from Limerick. The choice of port seemed odd at the time, but it might be explained by the Ennis estate lying in the countryside north of the town. Unsurprisingly, I decided we needed to know more about where the gunpowder was destined and for what purpose it was intended. So I worked my way deeper into the movement's hierarchy." He frowned. "The strange, and to be truthful, troubling fact was that no matter how high I went in the movement's upper ranks, no one seemed to know anything about this plot. No one was in charge of it, and it hadn't been discussed at any of the various inner council meetings."
"Did you reach deep enough, high enough, to be sure of that?" Sebastian asked.
Drake's expression hardened, and he glanced at his scraped knuckles.
"Yes, that's what nearly broke my cover. I kept going higher in the organization. But I should have been following a solid trail from the foot soldiers who arranged the shipment, the Connell Boynes of the Enterprise, to the upper echelons. But the moment I stepped away from the field, as it were, there was no trail, seemingly no connection whatsoever."
Drake raised his lids, and his golden gaze met Sebastian's eyes.
"And that makes me question whether this is, in fact, a young islander plot at all."
It was Sebastian's turn to frown.
"If not them, then..."
He spread his hands. "Who?"
"That, indeed, is the question."
Drake drummed a finger on the table.
"Someone over there, in the higher ranks, should have known about this plot, but no one did. Of that, I'm quite sure. While the young islanders, like any movement of its kind, has its more militant arms, I've never heard of a scheme of this ilk being run purely by the lower ranks, with no one in the upper echelons even being told of it. No well-organized movement encourages such things. Renegade actions, those implemented without the knowledge or approval of the higher councils, risk said higher councils losing control of the movement."
Drake fell silent, then his finger stilled. After a moment, he murmured,
"I wonder, could someone have seen the young islander hotheads as potential hands to exploit?"
Abandoning his sprawl, he leaned forward. With both forearms on the table, he cradled his goblet between his palms. His golden gaze was sharply intent and focused unseeing down the table.
"Has someone been clever enough to manipulate a group of young islander foot soldiers, including Connell Boyne, into thinking this plot is an officially sanctioned young islander plot, even though it isn't?"
"That would certainly account for Ennis suddenly wanting to speak with you."
Sebastian sipped, then lowered his goblet.
"Consider this scenario. Connell, believing he's acting for the movement, arranges in secret for the gunpowder to be shipped, then comes to England to visit with Ennis at Pressingstoke Hall and discuss the harvest and other estate matters, as he always does at this time of year. And while he's in Kent, to receive and hide the gunpowder, presumably directly off the ship, then to lead the men who arrive, to take it on to London, to the cavern. Either Ennis or Connell had to be there to show the ship's crew where the entrance to the cavern was, and later, to guide those who came with a wagon to take the barrels away.
But,
Antonia said,
Ennis knew nothing about the plot, not until Connell arrived at the hall and told him of it.
Drake was nodding.
Do you know when Connell arrived in Kent?
Sebastian exchanged a glance with Antonia. I believe it was a week before the house party.
Yes, Antonia said. Cecilia confirmed that.
The timing fits, Drake said. Connell tells Ennis as soon as he arrives at the hall. Assuming Ennis has been a supporter for years, and it's Ennis who has the money in the family, then Connell would have expected Ennis to be as committed to the plot as he himself was.
Speaking of money,
Antonia glanced at Sebastian, then turned back to Drake.
We forgot to mention that we found a half-burned envelope in the grate in Ennis's study after he was murdered. On the envelope was written £300 for... But the rest had burned away.
Drake nodded.
And that fits too. It would have fallen to Connell to pay the ship's captain for transporting the gunpowder, and so he had to tell Ennis all about the plot.
Connell expected to have Ennis's full and unequivocal support.
But Ennis saw the plot differently. He wasn't enthused at all. To his mind, such a plot would be a step too far, out of keeping with the movement's direction, and very possibly not in its best interests. Open rebellion on home soil and protests in London and in Parliament are one thing. But blowing up some building in London? Ennis was politician enough to know what that would lead to.
Sebastian snorted, even more heavy-handed repression.
Indubitably.
Drake paused, speculation growing in his golden gaze. After a moment, he went on.
I can imagine Ennis being prepared to give Connell the money to extricate Connell from this plot, even though Ennis intended subsequently to reveal all to the authorities, namely to me.
Sebastian nodded. That's why he insisted on meeting face to face. He would have demanded clemency, if not an outright amnesty, for his brother in return for revealing the details of the plot. Family loyalty, something to which we can all relate.
Unfortunately, Antonia said, in this instance, attempting to save his brother got Ennis, and his wife too, killed.
Both Sebastian and Drake grimaced, but neither disagreed. After a moment, Drake said, for all their hot-headedness, the Young Islander movement is not stupid enough to do something like this, not even their militant arms. As matters stand, there's no real benefit for them in it. Sebastian concurred with a grunt. A moment elapsed, then Sebastian looked at Drake. That brings us back to your earlier supposition. Idealistic young men are notoriously easy to recruit and also to mislead. For instance, by someone who thinks like you or your father. Drake swallowed a mouthful of wine.
There aren't, thank God, that many people in this world who think like His Grace. He quietly added, it would be frightening if there were.
Antonia looked from one to the other.
Frightening or not, time, gentlemen, is getting on, and we have 10 barrels of gunpowder that are presumably somewhere in London, in the hands of unknown plotters, whose intentions we can't begin to guess. So what are we going to do?
Drake looked at her, then looked at Sebastian, and straightened in his chair. He set down his goblet.
Aptly put.
He drummed the fingers of one hand on the table, then said,
I suggest we leave aside the question of exactly who is behind this, at least for now. Given that the only real use for 10 barrels of gunpowder is to blow something up, the more pressing questions facing us are...
He raised his hands and ticked off each point on his fingers.
What are they planning to blow up? When? And where is the gunpowder now?
Arguably the most pertinent of those questions, as of this moment, Sebastian said, is how long we have before they act. How long do we have to stop them?
That, Antonia put in. And how are we to approach answering Drake's 3 excellent and very pressing questions?
All three of them looked from one to the other. Silence reigned, deep enough for them to hear the ticking of the long case clock in the corner. Then Drake grimaced.
I fear I'm not at my best at this moment, and I suspect neither are you. Despite the likely urgency, making decisions in a fuzzy-headed state is never wise.
He glanced at the clock.
It's almost midnight. I suggest we reconvene tomorrow, after we've all had a decent night's sleep.
An excellent idea. Sebastian pushed back his chair.
Motion carried.
Antonia waited until Sebastian and Drake rose, and Sebastian pulled out her chair.
As she got to her feet, Drake said, We can meet here again. The parents are at Elverdon, and my brothers will be out, so we'll have the house to ourselves.
Sebastian and Antonia nodded. With Drake, they walked slowly into the front hall, where Hamilton was hovering. They strolled up the black and white tiles and halted before the front door. Hamilton retrieved their coats and Antonia's bonnet. After he'd assisted her to don her cloak, Antonia left him to help Sebastian while she turned to a large mirror and adjusted her bonnet. When they were ready, Drake, who'd been studying the floor, swung to face them, an amused light in his golden eyes.
As I take it, you two have parents to see, arrangements to discuss, and announcements to make.
His smug expression made it clear that, without any word of it passing their lips, he'd guessed their intentions.
And I need to catch up on rather a lot of sleep.
Shall we say 2 o'clock?
By Ton's schedules, that was still early in the day. Antonia arched a haughty brow.
2 o'clock will suit admirably.
She nodded to Hamilton, and he opened the door. With a dismissive,
Good night, Drake.
She walked briskly out onto the porch. Sebastian grinned, and he and Drake followed. Drake halted on the threshold. About to follow Antonia onto the porch, Sebastian halted, and curious met Drake's eyes.
Aren't you going to wish us well?
The light wasn't strong, but he would have sworn Drake faintly coloured. Drake glanced at Antonia, who was waiting, one brow arched expectantly for his reply. Then he looked back at Sebastian.
I would. I do.
He looked uneasy, an odd look for Drake.
Except,
he grimaced,
Once you make your announcement...
He met Sebastian's gaze.
I'm older than you.
Sebastian laughed and clapped Drake on the shoulder. He exchanged an amused look with Antonia, then murmured to Drake,
Perhaps it's time you faced the music, too.
Drake's expression turned genuinely horrified.
Thank you, but no.
His features set, and he reached out and seized the door. As chuckling, Sebastian walked onto the porch, joining Antonia. Drake stepped back and firmly shut the door behind them. Antonia laughed softly. She looped her arm in Sebastian's, and together they descended the steps to the pavement. A wide smile on her lips, she murmured,
Poor Drake.
They set out to walk the short distance to St. Ives' house, and Sebastian observed,
Matrimony appears to be one challenge our fearless Drake is in no hurry to face.
A few steps later, Antonia tilted her head. When Sebastian glanced her way, she caught his eyes. The obvious yet critical question hovered between them. They were ready to face what Drake still shied from, weren't they? The answer was there, in their eyes, clear enough for the other to see. Their expressions eased. As one, they faced forward. As one, they lengthened their stride. Chapter 16. Whether it was simply relief to be home again safe, with their part of the unfolding drama successfully played, at least to the end of this act, or welling exuberance over their triumph in having established a personal partnership that felt so very right. They were both smiling, and Antonia was actively reining in her delight when she swept into Sebastian's room. There'd been no staff downstairs to witness their entrance, just a lamp left burning low to light them up the grand staircase. In the gallery, his hand riding at the small of her back, Sebastian had guided her along the corridor into the east wing, then down another corridor to the room at the end. Antonia walked confidently across the large room. Over the years, she'd become familiar with much of St. Ives' house, but she hadn't ventured into any bedchamber except for that of Sebastian's sister, Louisa, which was in the west wing. As it happened, Sebastian's room was a mirror of Louisa's in placement and size, with a wide bank of windows directly opposite the door through which they'd entered, and a secondary door in the wall to Antonia's right that she knew would lead to a large bathing chamber. The two doors on either side of the main door would each open into one of the rooms back along the corridor. One room would be Sebastian's dressing room, with the other room, very likely rooms, reserved for his marchioness, his wife. The massive bed that stood against the wall to the right dominated the room. It was balanced by the huge fireplace in the opposite wall. As she crossed to the windows, she noted a pair of heavy tall boys against the other walls, a desk-cum-bureau against the wall between the windows and the fireplace, and four large, comfortable armchairs, one pair angled before the fireplace, the other pair placed to take advantage of the wide windows. She reached the uncurtained windows and looked out. Directly below, she glimpsed the edge of the terrace outside the family parlour. Beyond it, silvered by moonlight, spread the lawns and neat shrubs of that section of the mansion's rear garden. Curiosity welling, she turned and surveyed the room. Sconces set around the walls had been left turned low, shedding a warm glow throughout the chamber. The decor was a reflection of Sebastian, of his personality. Expensive, yes, yet a touch austere, with a ripple of rain passion, of innate power,
hidden beneath a smooth surface. The creamy ivory of the walls was offset by the richness of old oak, the warm patina glowing golden against the dark forest greens of upholstery and curtains. The frames of the twin oval mirrors flanking the mantelpiece and of the paintings on the walls were heavy and strong. Wilkins would keep the place tidy, but there was a book on the side table beside the armchair before the fireplace, a bookmark jutting at an angle from between the pages, and a riding crop and a pair of riding gloves had been discarded on the low table between the chairs by the windows. The mantelpiece held an eclectic array of odds and ends, scrimshaw, a set of carved ivory figurines, a large ormolu clock, two dueling pistols mounted in a display case, and two lamps, and stuck into the frame of the large restful landscape hanging above the fireplace were a selection of gilt-edged invitations. Then there was the bed, large and heavy, and sumptuously sensual with its forest green silk coverlet and the mound of ivory silk encased pillows at its head. Sebastian had paused in the doorway, watching her. As he stepped inside and shut the door, the clocks throughout the house struck 12. Midnight. Despite the light cast by the sconces, it was primarily moonlight that lit his face, his long body, as he strolled slowly toward her. He halted before her, the piercing quality of his gaze muted by the moonlight. He studied her face. On the two previous occasions they'd come together, they'd been driven, not just by their newly discovered desires, but also by a sense of, for one reason or another, needing to seize the moment. Tonight, there was no such blinding imperative. They both knew they could have each other, would have each other, time and again, in the days, months, and years to come. That they'd already agreed, albeit without any declaration other than their passions. So tonight, there was no need to rush, no sense of urgency to infuse their touch. Not yet. As if he could hear her thoughts, as if he shared them, he raised one hand and with one fingertip traced the line of her cheek from temple to jaw. Even as that single finger slid beneath her chin and nudged it upward, she was rising on her toes. He bent his head and brushed his lips across hers. Once, then again. Then his lips settled, and he kissed her. Gently. Yearningly. With an invisible beckoning, she felt tug at her soul. She'd forgotten, overlooked the fact he was a master, that in this sphere he was openly classed as an expert, as the warlock she'd sometimes thought him, with his strange pale green eyes. He wove a web of sensuality about her, slowly, with touches that mesmerized, with caresses that burned. She followed his lead and returned the pleasure, and he allowed it. He proceeded slowly enough for her to take her own time, managing their reins, keeping them relaxed as they ambled along a road they'd already travelled. But this time, they went slowly enough to fully appreciate the landscape on both sides. While their lips supped, tasting, exploring, reassuring, he drew off her bonnet, languidly tossed it on the nearby chair, then shrugged off his greatcoat and let it fall to the floor before he helped her shed her cloak. Sometime later, he sank to his knees before her. "Lift your skirts." The rumbling order was only just discernible. Without rush, she obeyed. She gathered the folds of her carriage dress and ruffled petticoats and raised the hems, high enough for him to reach beneath, glide one palm up the back of her leg, then release her garter and roll her stocking down. He undid the laces of her half-boot and eased both boot and stocking from her foot. Then, still moving to that slow, regimented beat, he repeated the process with her other leg, bearing it and leaving her standing barefoot. Smoothly he rose, and she let her skirts fall. Practicing such restraint raised tension of a different sort, of a type she sensed would later break through their control and compel them. But for those moments in which they stood communing in the moonlight, that seemed an entirely reasonable toll to pay. She pressed against him, her hand sliding up the wall of his chest to lightly grip his shoulders. His arms closed around her, then crushed her to him. Their lips met, and hunger leapt, and she rejoiced. And the kiss flared, hot, too hot, as if both sensed the danger, the threat to their control. They drew back, and together broke the kiss. He trailed his lips to her ear, then down along her jaw, planting nibbling little kisses that distracted her senses and helped her to step back from the fiery lure. Their breathing gradually steadied. Determined to succeed in this novel endeavor, to maintain the measured tempo of this heady new dance, she drew in a slow, steadying breath and set her fingers to the folds of his cravat. She drew out the heavy gold pin with its large pale peridot, the gem the same color as his eyes. After anchoring the pin in his lapel, she eased the ends of the cravat free of his waistcoat and shirt. While her fingers unraveled the simple knot, the winding folds, she felt his fingers sliding free the buttons that ran down the back of her carriage dress. His lips were curved when, in the waning moonlight, they again brushed hers, again left hers hungering. Needing an anchor, a more definite distraction, and judging from the increasing tension gripping him that he might welcome the same, she murmured, "Once we break the news to our families, all hell will break loose, socially speaking." His lips drifted to her temple, his breath a wash of heat across her cheek. "Do you think they'll be surprised?" Wry cynicism colored the words. She uttered a short laugh. "I doubt it will be any great shock." The last word turned breathless as his fingertips, just the tips, brushed her bare skin as the back of her tightly fitted carriage dress gaped. This slowness, this lack of rush, this measured pace was tensing her nerves and heightening sensation in a wholly novel way, on a plane of elevated intensity. A fresh challenge. She felt his lips trail down her throat. She tipped her head back and, in an effort to cling to control, gabbled the first thought that came to her. "And yet no one ever tried to steer me your way." He raised his head. The moonlight etched his features as he caught her hands and drew them from his now loosened cravat. Then he reached for the shoulders of her dress and drew the bodice forward and down, sliding the sleeves down her arms. She eased her hands from the tight sleeves, then pushed and sent the dress with its wide skirts slithering to pool in a heap about her feet. She felt his gaze brush heat over her breasts, over her torso, screened though they still were by chemise and corset. His voice had deepened and grown rougher when he said, "No one mentioned your name to me either." His gaze remained locked on her breasts. She heard him draw in a deeper breath, all but sensed him tighten his hold on his own reins. Then he grasped her waist, spun her about, and set his fingers to the laces of her petticoats. A second later he said,
"It's curious, now I think of it, that none of the grand dames we both know ever pushed me in your direction."
He seemed to be concentrating on unravelling the laces. Then he asked,
"Did your mother or the others ever steer you toward anyone?"
She frowned.
"No. They always seemed to be waiting for me to choose."
Oh. She realized what he was suggesting.
"You think that they knew all along, and we were the only ones who didn't?"
That thought wasn't comforting. He grunted, and the waistband of her petticoats loosened.
"Let's not think about that. The gloating will be enough to endure if and when it occurs."
"Indeed."
Between them, they pushed down the froth of cotton and lace that was her multi-layered petticoats. Taking her hand, he steadied her as she stepped free of the pile. She would have turned and walked into his arms, but his hands gripped her waist again, and he drew her back until her derriere met his thighs. She leaned against him, her shoulders to his chest, and tipped her head back. He bent his, and their lips met again in a teasing temptation of a kiss. Then he raised his head, and their lips parted. He didn't straighten, but through the shadows studied her face, watched her reactions as he cruised his palms upward, then closed his hands about her breasts. Her eyes locked with his. She drew in a slow, tense breath, then couldn't release it. She felt trapped in his gaze as he kneaded her flesh. Then his artful fingers cruised the firm mounds, circling the puckered buds of her nipples, then closing, tightening. Her lids fell, her spine arched, and she gasped and heard the sound hover in the dimness, as if it came from someone else. He played, and her body bowed against his, her breasts pressing into his palms, an invitation he didn't refuse. Yet still they danced to that slow rousing, a rousing beat. Power of a sort she hadn't encountered before, strange and compelling, rose and wreathed about them. His hands possessed, then shaped the lines of her body, her hips, thighs, and derriere, barely screened by the fine cotton of her chemise and drawers. Her breathing had quickened, and her senses had come alive, when he eased back an inch, steadied her, then withdrew his supporting hands, and set his fingers to the laces of her corset. Sebastian felt the power driving the desire that thudded, heavy and resounding through his veins, through his body, his mind, reaching into his soul, a compulsive beat that held him to its rigid cadence, slow, slow, slow. The better to appreciate, to know and savour,